Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, December 4th, 2020. Here are some of your headlines. President-elect Joe Biden calling the November jobs report grim and saying it shows an economy that is stalling. Labor Department says 245,000 jobs were created. Debt employment rate falling from 6.9% to 6.7%. But about 10 million pre-coronavirus pandemic jobs have still not been recovered. President-elect Biden calling for more economic stimulus. And today, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi sounding optimistic that a bill could pass and be signed into law soon. She said it would be combined with the regular government funding measure that also must be passed by next week to avert a government shutdown. Also today, former President Barack Obama and Vice President Mike Pence campaigning in Georgia with the U.S. Senate candidates there involved in runoff elections, two of them scheduled for January, and that'll determine which party controls the Senate in the next Congress. And the U.S. House passing a bill to decriminalize marijuana at the federal level and also expunge federal criminal records for nonviolent marijuana offenses. First time such a bill has passed Congress. A story at CNN Business reads, hiring in the U.S. is now so slow it could take another 40 months for the job market to fully recover from the pandemic. The U.S. economy added 245,000 jobs in November on a seasonally adjusted basis, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported Friday. It was 224,000 fewer than economists had expected, and a massive slowdown from the 610,000 jobs added in October. As the economy is growing more sluggish, the unemployment rate inching down to 6.7% from 6.9% in October, but the drop occurred because more workers left the labor force in November. That was all from CNN. President-elect Joe Biden spoke to reporters at his transition base and home, Wilmington, Delaware.
Early today, the November jobs report was released, and it was grim. It shows an economy that's stalling, and we remain in the midst of one of the worst economic and job crises in modern history. But it doesn't have to stay that way. If we act now, we can begin to regain momentum and start to build back a better future. There's no time to lose. Millions of people have lost their jobs or had their hours slashed. They've lost their health insurance or are in danger of losing their health insurance. One in every six renters is behind in rent. One in four small businesses can't keep their doors open. And there's a growing gap in Black and Latino unemployment, and the gap remains much too large. And it's deeply troubling that last month's drop in overall unemployment was driven by people who were dropping out of the job market, not because more people were being hired. Dropping out of the job market altogether. They've lost hope of finding a job, or they're taking full-time caregiving responsibilities as child centers remain closed and their children learn remotely. Over the past 3 months, 2.3 million more people are long-term unemployed, meaning for 23 weeks or more. By far the largest increase on record. This is a dire jobs report. It's a snapshot, I might remind you, up to mid-November. Before the surge in COVID cases we predicted, many predicted, and the deaths rise that we've seen in December as we head into a very dark winter ahead.
President-elect Joe Biden in Delaware. More on the jobs report and prospects for another economic aid package from the government. That's coming up in a moment. But first, President-elect Biden took reporters' questions today, and one was about his cabinet nominations.
And on your cabinet, you are facing a lot of pressure to add more diversity to your administration. You have civil rights groups and lawmakers pushing you to do this, to make sure that you make good on your promise. And you look at your cabinet announcement so far, and they have included some diverse figures, but I specifically want to hone in on those big four. And so far, when it comes to Secretary of State and Treasury, you have nominated a white man and a white woman. So looking at Attorney General and the Department of Defense, would you commit to nominating a person of color for those positions?
Look, it's each one of these groups' jobs to push their leaders to make sure there's greater diversity. What I can promise you is when this is all said and done, you see everyone that I've announced and who's going to be in the next several weeks, we'll have it all out there, you're going to see significant diversity. I'm not going to tell you now exactly what I'm going to do in any department, but I promise you, it'll be the single most diverse cabinet based on race, color, based on gender that's ever existed in the United States of America.
So no commitment on those spots?
A commitment of what I just said will be the most diverse cabinet and the main spots in both White House as well as the cabinet positions.
Thank you.
President-elect Joe Biden taking reporters' questions in Wilmington, Delaware. Back to the jobs report, an article in the Hill newspaper reads, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi expressed optimism Friday that the parties will come together to secure a coronavirus relief package before Congress leaves Washington for the holidays. Pelosi had spoken Thursday with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell seeking a strategy for passing both an emergency COVID-19 bill and legislation to fund the government and prevent a shutdown. Both sides emerged from that discussion in agreement that the two bills should be lumped together for the sake of expediency, a message Pelosi amplified on Friday. That was from The Hill. Here is House Speaker Pelosi at her weekly briefing.
You probably did see the jobs report this morning, which is indicative of the need for us to have crushed the virus so the economy can get going. So all of that is to come to this place to say there is momentum. There is momentum with the action that the senators and House members in a bipartisan way have taken with them. It could provide meaning relief for millions who are suffering economically, personally, health-wise. And so I'm pleased that the tone of our conversations is one that is indicative of the decision to get the job done. That, I'll take any questions you may have.
I heard what you said about momentum. Realistically, how soon do you and Leader McConnell need to cut a deal in order to have a package to vote on before the holidays?
We have the time to do it. We want to have it on the omnibus. We have to have an omnibus, and we're hoping that that will accelerate the discussions on the omnibus. We are going to keep government open. You know, we're not going to have a continuing resolution, but we need to take the time to do that. And then, as I said, we saw a framework. They're putting, now they have to turn it into text. And then, so we'll take the time we need, and we must get it done. And we must get it done by this before we leave.
So does that
we
mean
cannot leave without it.
So does that mean you have about a week to negotiate?
It doesn't matter. We will take the time that we need. And the question is, when will the text be ready so that we can combine it into the... But the omnibus is not finished yet. We have a number of what we call ash and trash. It's a lot of other issues that need to be resolved, and they're in the course of doing that.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi at her weekly briefing with reporters on Capitol Hill talking about two bills, that the omnibus bill, the federal government spending bill that's being worked on. Also, she mentioned turning a bill into a proposal into legislative text. That is the bipartisan coronavirus economic aid bill, $908 billion. Unveiled by Democratic and Republican House and Senate members earlier this week. A view on the jobs report today and coronavirus aid from the Trump administration. Larry Kudlow, director of the National Economic Council, spoke to reporters outside the White House.
Yes, ma'am. You and the president were always pretty quick to take credit when things were going well for the economy. So where is the president right now when so many people are suffering?
Well, look, there's a lot of suffering out there, I agree. But I will also argue the economy has registered a very strong comeback from the peak of the pandemic contraction, including today's jobs numbers with a 6.7% unemployment rate. Now, there's still over 10 million people who are jobless, and that's not good, and that is hardship. And by the way, That should be a target of any assistance package. However, at the peak, it was 23 million. And we now got 150 million Americans working. And that's way up, and the 10 million who are unemployed is way down. So I like that. And I want to say also, look at, in terms of these numbers, I know you're not going to get deep in the numbers, but you've still got, there's a housing boom going on, consumer spending is strong, there's a lot of business and factory production going on. The ISMs and the PMIs were nearly 60%. That's a very healthy number. You look at that, it looks, all that stuff looks like a V. My friend, one of Wall Street's top economists, Ed Hyman, has his Christmas tree index, and that's growing at 29% year on year, a little holiday cheer. So, I think we have much more work to do. I understand that. But I think we've come a long way.
Where is the president? Nearly 2,000
people there are
dying
right now
of COVID, obviously having economic impacts. Where is the president's leadership on this?
I don't understand.
Where is the president? We're not hearing from him about COVID or about economic relief or about helping these people who are unemployed.
Well, he has spoken on unemployed. He favors a targeted assistance package. He's always favored that.
Larry Kudlow, director of the National Economic Council, in the White House driveway with reporters. On Wall Street today, the Dow was up 248 points, NASDAQ up 87, S&P up 32. Despite the coronavirus pandemic, Americans traveled by car over the Thanksgiving holiday only a little less than a year ago, 5% less compared to 2019, according to an analysis by Streetlight data provided to the Associated Press. We learned this week of a proposal to severely reduce some public transit service in the Washington, D.C. area starting next summer to cope with the steep drop-off in ridership on Metrorail and Metrobus due to the coronavirus pandemic, this if more federal money is not provided. WMATA, the Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority Board Finance Committee, took up the measure today. Steve McMillan is the chair.
Just like our current budget, Metro's fiscal outlook for next year continues to be driven by the effects of the ongoing pandemic, namely a dramatic decrease in passenger traffic and associated revenue. So the impacts of that reduced fare revenue have been mitigated somewhat this year with the help of federal dollars. However, we have no ability to plan on any continued assistance at this point. So Metro is proposing a service plan that prioritizes essential travel and ensures that the network will be in place as the region begins to recover. We have come up with a plan that is going to be tough medicine for many of our stakeholders, but we have a responsibility to budget with the dollars we have available and provide the most logical and meaningful service that we can within those constraints. We expect that we will begin recovery during fiscal year 22, but we need to budget conservatively for a gradual return of our riders as economic and other activity begins to pick up. The proposal assumes that we will achieve approximately 34% of our pre-pandemic ridership during the course of that fiscal year.
Steve McMillan is a WMATA board member at today's Finance Committee meeting held virtually. The proposal includes closing 19 stations, ending weekend service, and personnel layoffs. Still needs to go through several committees and full board votes before it could take effect next summer. And of course, it may not happen if there is additional federal money provided to the transit agency, an issue facing Washington, D.C., and probably many other cities around the country. This is Washington Today. Now to the two U.S. Senate runoff elections in Georgia. Former President Barack Obama campaigning for the Democratic candidates today, Vice President Mike Pence for the Republicans. First, here is Barack Obama at a virtual event.
You've got two candidates in Vernon Warnock and John Ossoff who have shown themselves repeatedly to operate at the highest levels of integrity. And let's face it, you've got two incumbent senators who, in the midst of the worst public health crisis that any of us have seen in our lifetimes, we know were first and foremost worried about their stock portfolio. Goodness gracious. That alone should tell you something. Somehow we've become inured to this kind of stuff. But when you've got a couple of senators who are downplaying a pandemic, towing the line of a president who botches the response to the pandemic, despite the fact that my administration had given them an actual playbook on how to deal with pandemics, and then as they're downplaying it, as they're ignoring the science and epidemiologists and suggesting that, you know, this is something that is some partisan issue as opposed to something that Americans should rally around, at the same time, behind closed doors, they're calling their brokers? That's not public service. And so that alone should motivate, I hope, the people of Georgia to say, we want somebody in there who cares about us and who's thinking about us and is working for us every day.
Former President Barack Obama in an online rally. A new poll from SurveyUSA, commissioned by an Atlanta TV station, shows Democrats in both of the U.S. Senate runoff elections ahead of the Republicans. In one, Raphael Warnock leading Republican Kelly Loeffler 52% to 45%. And in the other, John Ossoff leading David Perdue 50% to 48%. Vice President Mike Pence started his day in Atlanta at CDC headquarters, joined by the two Republican Senate candidates for an update on coronavirus vaccines. Then the three went to Savannah for a rally. Here is Vice President Pence.
I'm here on the president's behalf because we need Georgia to send two great senators back to a Republican majority in Washington. We need to send them back because of who they are. We need to send them back because of all that we accomplished together. And we need to send them back because a Republican Senate majority could be the last line of defense, preserving all that we've done to defend this nation, revive our economy, and preserve the God-given liberties we hold dear. But I'm here because of who they are. David Perdue is a son of Macon. Worked his way to the top of the business world, but he answered the call to public service. After spending 40 years as one of the most successful business leaders in America, he decided to serve Georgia. And I can tell you firsthand, he's a principled conservative, a man of deep conviction and faith. And Senator David Perdue has been one of the greatest allies of our administration in Washington, D.C. And another incredible leader, Kelly Loeffler, fourth generation on her family's grain farm. She built her own company up from the ground. She broke barriers in business and sports to become one of Georgia's most successful businesswomen. And I can tell you again, in a very short period of time, she's emerged as one of the most important conservative voices on Capitol Hill. We need Senator Kelly Loeffler back in Washington, D.C.
Vice President Mike Pence in Savannah, Georgia. Washington Post reports the number of absentee ballot requests for the January 5th Georgia runoff elections surpassed 1 million as of 11 p.m. on Thursday, and that's nearly 71% of the 1.45 million requests received by October 2nd, the equivalent number of days ahead of the November general election. President Donald Trump will be holding a rally for the Republican candidates David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler in Valdosta, Georgia, on Saturday. Live coverage begins at 7 p.m. Eastern on C-SPAN. This comes as the Associated Press writes, the Republicans in the state are roiled by President Trump's continued denial of his own defeat and his baseless attacks that Republican officials in Georgia, including the governor and secretary of state, enabled widespread voter fraud on behalf of President-elect Joe Biden. Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines as the FDA gets set to approve next week a Pfizer-BioNTech coronavirus vaccine for emergency use in the U.S. Today, Bahrain became the second country to already grant that emergency use to that vaccine. First country was the United Kingdom. And states face a deadline today to place orders for the coronavirus vaccine, as many reported record infections, hospitalizations, and deaths. Hospitalizations topped 100,000 on Thursday, according to the COVID tracking project, an all-time high. And the U.S. Supreme Court said it would consider the Trump administration's request to reinstate work rules for some Medicaid enrollees. U.S. House of Representatives passing a bill today to decriminalize and tax marijuana at the federal level. Bill would also expunge the criminal records of nonviolent offenders of marijuana-related crimes dating back to 1970. When the drug was classified as a controlled substance. The bill is called the MORE Act. That stands for Marijuana Opportunity, Reinvestment, and Expungement. Speaking on the House floor in favor, Sheila Jackson Lee, a Democrat.
Thousands of men and women have suffered needlessly from the federal criminalization of marijuana, particularly in communities of color, and have borne the burden of collateral consequences for those ensnared in the criminal legal system that have damaged our society across generations. This is unacceptable, and we must change our laws. It is time for Congress to catch up with the reforms that states are enacted. It's time for Congress to catch up with Americans. 36 states, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and Guam, have adopted laws allowing legal access to cannabis. 15 states, the District of Columbia, and the Northern Mariana Islands, have adopted laws for legalizing cannabis for adult recreational use. A total of 47 states have reformed their laws in one form or another pertaining to cannabis despite its federal criminalization. The state legal cannabis industry already employs almost 250,000 people, and the federal government needs to get out of the way of state-level decisions-making for their citizens. We need to open the door to research, better banking and tax laws. We need to help fuel economic growth in this industry. We need to save lives. We need to help young people. We need to bring our nation together. And we need to do this without continuing to spend federal resources on criminalization and unjust incarceration for marijuana offenses.
Democratic Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee. Opposing this bill, Republican Debbie Lesko.
According to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, studies have suggested specific links between marijuana use and adverse consequences in the workplace, such as increased risk for injuries or accidents. According to the federal government's own workplace safety experts at the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, or NIOSH, other studies of cannabis use have demonstrated effects that include sedation, disorientation, impaired judgment, lack of concentration, and slowed fine motor skills. And as my Democratic colleagues often say, we need to follow the science. Currently, it is common practice for employers in industries such as construction and warehouse logistics to enact zero-tolerance drug policies that include a prohibition on marijuana usage to protect workers by ensuring a safe workplace and to comply with federal law. Unlike on-demand evaluations of alcohol usage, there currently is no adequate real-time intoxication testing technology for marijuana impairment. By removing marijuana from the list of scheduled substances in the Controlled Substance Act, the underlying bill will place unnecessary burdens on private employers and will needlessly jeopardize workplace and public safety and health.
Debbie Lesko on the House floor. This bill passed the House of Representatives today, 228-164. It was overwhelmingly along party lines, just 5 Republicans voting yes and 6 Democrats voting no. Bill now heads to the Senate, and we spoke with Politico reporter Natalie Furtig.
It will not come up in the Senate. There's a week and a half left, and Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said that he is not in favor of any sort of comprehensive marijuana reform. It would definitely be a miracle if it came up in the Senate this session.
So pushing this into the 117th Congress would result in the same result then?
Yes. A lot can happen in 2 years. I've been covering cannabis for 2 years, and 2 years ago, I probably would not have bet money on this bill coming up. But a lot has happened this year, from the focus on criminal justice reform to states deciding that cannabis was an essential business during the pandemic, that has also changed the minds of maybe many moderate Democrats in the House. So I won't say that nothing will happen in the next Congress, but it's a very big uphill battle if Republicans retain the Senate after the Georgia runoff.
Natalie Furtig, Politico's federal cannabis policy reporter, joining us on C-SPAN's Washington Journal Friday morning. If Democrats, though, take control of the Senate with those Georgia runoffs in January, it may have a better chance, this bill, since Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer supports marijuana decriminalization, as does President-elect Joe Biden. But if Republicans keep Senate control, that means another 2 years of divided government, Democrats holding the U.S. House and presidency. Two former leaders of the House, Republican John Boehner, who served as Speaker, and Joe Crowley, who was Democratic caucus chair, talked today about what that means for the policy agenda. First, Speaker Boehner.
Divided government has served America pretty well over the last 200 years, and it looks like we may be headed toward divided government once again. Of course, there are two Senate races in Georgia that are yet to be decided. But for this conversation, my assumption is we're going to end up having divided government. And as you look at the new administration, they're going to find, I think, some opportunities to work with the Congress. It's not going to be easy. It never is. It was never intended to be easy. But when it comes to the makeup of the new cabinet, I think you'll see Republicans on the Hill, by and large, be supportive of the president-elect's picks. There will be a couple, I would guess, that aren't going to quite pass the test. But there's going to be, I think, quite a bit of respect for the people that President-elect Biden chooses for his cabinet.
Yeah, I would really agree with John on this, Speaker Boehner. I think the American people expect that the Senate will cooperate and give to President-elect Joe Biden what he's entitled to, and that is a working, workable cabinet. So I wouldn't necessarily call that bipartisanship as much as it's the expectation the American people have placed on the Senate in their role to confirm. And so I think that we may very well see, I would anticipate we will see some Republicans in that mix. Some will have an easier time than others. I know that from the outset, my good friend Neera Tanden has been kind of singled out so far. I think she's wonderful. You know, in this world of hyper-partisanship, to criticize her for having been partisan and supporting Joe Biden when some of the verbiage that we've had to deal with over the last 4 years, she really pales in comparison to that. In terms of the use of that. And so she's a person of substance, and I hope that that's not the person that people target and say, here's our problem, so to speak. But who knows? We'll see what happens.
Former House Democratic Caucus Chair Joe Crowley, talking about Neera Tanden, nominated for White House Budget Director. You also heard from former House Speaker John Boehner, a Republican. They were at a virtual conversation this Friday hosted by the Meridian International Center. Also taking part, former Transportation Secretary Rodney Slater. You can find the full event previewing the Joe Biden administration at our video library at cspan.org. More on what President Biden will be facing in the areas of national security and foreign policy. Former CIA Director John Brennan was at an event held by CSIS.
I think the Biden-Harris administration is going to face many challenges and threats and risks on day one and throughout the course of its administration. In addition to having to deal with a very, very challenging domestic environment here in terms of hyper-partisanship, the COVID pandemic, as well as the economic dislocations and disruptions associated with that, it's going to inherit a world stage that the United States really needs to deal with from day one. And I think they have a number of priorities in order to address the real as well as the emerging threats that are out there. I think high on the agenda is going to be trying to repair some of those alliances and partnerships, those relationships with the United States' traditional allies and partners around the world, because the United States' strength on that global trade stage really is derived from those relationships that have been built up really over the last 75 years. In addition, I think they're going to try to have a constructive dialogue with both China and Russia. I mean, these are big, big countries that the United States and the Biden administration is going to have to deal with on day one. In addition, they're going to have to deal with proliferation matters, specifically dealing with Iran and North Korea. These are issues that I know that Tony Blinken and Jake Sullivan and other members of the national security team are focused on, and we'll have to deal with it early on. Also, just reasserting the United States' role on that global stage. I think during the Trump administration, there has been a conscious effort to recede from some of those responsibilities and participation in multilateral organizations, such as the United Nations, the WHO, and others. And finally, I think it's to deal with some of those more concerning longer-term threats that are very insidious in terms of their impact on the international stage, which is climate change, cyber, other pandemics that might be out there. So again, I think the real challenge is dealing with all of these issues simultaneously and ensuring that there's going to be the appropriate allocation of resources and attention dedicated to all of them, again, domestically as well as internationally.
Former CIA Director John Brennan at CSIS, the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Brennan has also been a critic of President Trump over the election claims, accusing the president of trying to steal the election after the president fired the head of a federal cybersecurity agency who said this year's election was secure. Thanks for joining us on Washington Today. Get the free C-SPAN radio app to take C-SPAN with you, and also get our podcast, including of this program, wherever you get your podcasts. Have a good night and a good weekend.